This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today I'm talking to Tony Vanderwarker. He's the author of a new novel called Sleeping Dogs, but also a companion nonfiction book publishing at the same time called Writing with the Master. How are you, Tony?
I'm well, David. How are you?
Good. So maybe you could, I mean, I think part of your story, you probably ought to tell this. You know, there's an interesting connection between you and famous author John Grisham, and maybe you want to talk a little bit about how this writing career of yours came to be.
Sure, I'd be happy to. I had seven unpublished novels wasting away on my hard drive when I happened to be having lunch with Grisham. He's a friend and neighbor, and he said, "How's your writing going?" And I said, "Well, you know, it's a bit of an uphill, but it's coming along." And he said, "You know, I'd be glad to mentor you, help you write a thriller if you'd like." Well, after I fell out of my chair, I said, "Absolutely." And as we ate lunch, he said, "You know, we're going to need a subject." And I said, "Well, I got a couple." I pitched one to him. He said, "Nah, that won't work." I pitched another one to him, and he shot that down. I mean, just right off the bat without even thinking about it. And I pitched the third one to him, and I was sweating a bit, and he said, "Wow, I really like that." So the pitch I gave to him, which was, there are 11 unrecovered nuclear weapons scattered around the United States as a result of collisions and mid-air mishaps during the Cold War, and what if a bunch of interested parties went after one of those nuclear weapons?
And I did want to ask you, you know, I've read the book, and I don't want to give away the story, but I wanted to ask you about that kind of the underlying issue there. I mean, is this, that is a true thing, the 11 nuclear bombs that from the 50s and 60s, they actually are somewhere out there?
Yeah, Brookings Institute, authenticates that on the web, at least. And it's been written about a number of times. They're in different locations. Some are unretrievable because they're in deep water. But others, they don't quite know where they are because they went down in hurricanes or in storms. The planes jettison them in hurricanes or storms and without a clear idea of what the coordinates were. So where they are is anybody's guess. I mean, what condition they are is anybody's guess, which makes it perfect fodder for a novelist.
Oh, yeah, because, it gives you instantaneous kind of attraction, you know, that when we read that there are these kind of terrifying objects out there that and of course, you give the, you know, you give the beginning of the story, I think, which we can talk about. Your main character, Howie Collier, is a professor who goes around lecturing about and has a website that documents these missing nuclear weapons. And, you know, the setup, I guess, is that he's been thrown out of the Department of Defense as just a pain in the butt, but that there is this secret organization within the Pentagon whose job it is to essentially protect those nuclear weapons. But really, they're protecting them from being talked about as much as they are protecting them where they are.
Right. That's why that novel is called Sleeping Dogs, because that's the way the Pentagon, this group at the Pentagon you described, wants to maintain them as out of the way, harmless. You know, just don't wake them up and it won't cause any problems.
Right. And so that's a pretty good setup. I can see why both you and Grisham were attracted to it, because it gives you a propellant, essentially, for a great story.
Right. And what was so interesting about this process, and the reason I ended up writing with the master about it, was that Grisham put me through his plot development process, which is grueling. I didn't know it at the time, but it's grueling and demanding and lengthy. And he came to it after he took 3 years writing The Firm, and he wrote he wrote Time to Kill in 3 years. He decided to use an outline when he wrote The Firm, and it took him 6-8 months to write that. So he said, if I'm going to crank out books on a regular yearly basis, I better start outlining seriously. So he's become a devotee of the outline process because it helps him get his plots down so that he has confidence they're going to hold up for 350 pages. You know, he explains that it's easy doing the opening of a novel and it's easy doing the ending. It's the 300 pages in the middle.
So did he talk to you about how he developed his own process of plotting, which I take it that you then went through as with him as your mentor, you went through the same process with him. In other words, he taught you this method.
Correct. Yeah, and it's nothing more than going through and building a plot structure that holds up, that has enough legs to get through to 360 pages. And it's bizarre how you can come up with a plot and think it'll hold up, but when you start really poking at it and pushing it and demanding that it keep moving, that you find out it runs out of gas, and then you're up the creek without a paddle.
So would you think it's fair to say that this idea, this method of building a novel, is similar to the architectural work in building a building? That
absolutely, it's the same thing. And what's so curious is that it works for some writers and not for others.
I mean,
Grisham, you know, he got his degree in accountancy, and then he went to law school. So he's a very organized guy with a very organized mind. Stephen King, on the other hand, can't stand plots. He thinks they're superfluous and stupid. I mean, and he talks at length about how useless they are. He just puts characters in an interesting situation and watches them and sees how they develop. So it's two totally different ways of writing, and it depends on what kind of person you are, I guess, more than anything else.
Or maybe also the type of story you want to tell.
Of course, yes, that too, yeah. Yeah, if you're into a literary story where it's character-driven, the characters will do most of your plotting for you, and the plot isn't that critical. But if you're into a thriller situation, the characters are less important, and the plot is all important.
Right. Well, no, I think that's a really interesting distinction, and it does. I think it makes sense that the thriller stories that work, you don't notice that they've been crafted. They seem. I mean, that's the essence of great design, is that you don't know that they've been designed.
Exactly. Seamless. Yeah, and he also taught me some other things that were pretty interesting. And his point is, if you can't explain your novel in one succinct sentence, you probably shouldn't write it. Like for The Firm, he describes it in one sentence as a ambitious young lawyer gets a dream job that turns out to be a nightmare.
Right. No, it's almost that's similar to what I think entrepreneurs, young entrepreneurs, are told. You have to be able to describe your business in the that one sentence or maybe two, but it's not just the elevator pitch, but it's the way of encapsulating the idea. What's the essence of your story?
Right. And if you don't do that, you find yourself wandering off focus. And you find your story going in a direction that you didn't intend it to go in, and maybe you get 120 or 160 pages down the road, and you go, wait a minute, this isn't what I was writing about at all. So it's really critical to have that critical analysis in one sentence of what you're talking about.
And, now, would it be also fair to say that so you have the essence of the story, and you kind of keep that, maybe you write that down and paste it on the wall in front of your computer so you're never off your message, essentially. But is it possible that as you're writing the book and you've done all this careful plotting, but you then come to something as you're writing that you want to change? What happens then?
He has a mechanism for dealing with that, which is called a chapter outline. He put me writing six outlines until he finally got the plot cooking. And then he said, now I have a chapter outline. And I said, I beg your pardon? I said, I'm supposed to write the book before I write the book? And he said, in a sense, yes, but what your chapter outline enables you to do is develop subplots as you go along, and you keep changing the chapter outline to reflect those subplots, and it keeps you honest. You know where your next chapter is going to go, so you don't wander off. He points out that many authors will fall into the subplot that wanders off into nowhere, or a couple subplots that wander off into nowhere, and you as a reader have experienced, and I'm sure, or you're reading a book and you're going, where is this author taking me, and why? And that's a very frustrating experience for a reader, and usually results in the book being set aside. So I came up with this description of John's chapter outline and developing subplots as stringing pearls. You want the subplots to all be parallel to the main plot, and then come back into the plot line at some point in time. And if they don't, they're spurious and shouldn't be included. So it was a two-year lesson that ended up with a pretty good book.
I will say, having read the book, I really liked it, and I think, you know, it's a really good story, and of course your characters. I mean, you still have to have characters. You can't, even though it may be plot driven, you still have to have characters that we as readers will relate to and accept as valid in doing what they're supposed to do. So you still have to have characters that fit the story.
Absolutely, and I worked hard on that. I mean, at one point, John was telling me that people who read my previous books didn't like my people, and he said, "You really got to work on making your people likable right from the get-go." I mean, you can have villains and bad guys and everything, but your hero has to be somebody that the reader can root for. This is in thrillers, and that they can really hope comes through the trial and tribulation.
And the bad guys have to get their comeuppance.
Exactly. Right.
Because yours definitely do. I won't give away plot, but your bad guys, who are really, I mean, and you had this tricky, I don't want to say little thing, but tricky element to your story, and that is the, quote, bad guys are, they're Americans. They're not necessarily the kind of villains. You do have some bad guys who truly are villains. Again, I don't want to go too deeply into. I think we can say you have two competing elements there, who are chasing after your main character, who's chasing after this one particular nuclear weapon.
Right.
One being the Pentagon, who wants to keep it from being discovered for their own reasons, and then the other one being a terrorist cell who wants to find it for their own nasty reasons. And
right, exactly.
And so those are there. You have two sets of bad guys in a way.
Exactly. And Grisham described the plot as, when I wandered off at one point, he said, "Look, your story is about an old pilot who leads a disgraced Pentagon whistleblower, who leads Al-Qaeda, who leads the Pentagon to an unrecovered nuclear weapon. That's it." I mean, it's sort of and then, but
right.
There are a lot of people involved.
Right. No, and it's great. You obviously had to do some juggling to keep all these people together. Plus, you have the families of the kind of protagonists. You know, they have to, and you have some good guy supporters too. So you have a lot of moving parts.
It's a complicated novel, but it all came together in the end, and it was a tremendous amount of revising and reworking, and I initially didn't meet with much success in my first submission, so I really went to town on it and really worked it over. I wrote the Writing with the Master and at the same time, and then both were sort of ready for prime time at the same time, and they both got picked up.
So you sent these two books were sent out to publishers as a pair.
They were not originally. It just serendipitously, a couple publishers who were interested said, I really like this Writing with the Master, and I think other people are going to like it, but they're going to be curious about Sleeping Dogs also. Why don't you let me take a look at that? And, you know, my agent said, of course, take a look. And one of the publishing houses ended up making an offer for both.
So it's interesting. So just strategically, your agent took the writing with the master as the book to publishers rather than the novel.
Right. Yeah, because the novel had been rejected previously, and I didn't submit the novel to him originally. I just submitted Writing with the Master. I sort of assumed that Sleeping Dogs was going to be, you know, permanently relegated to my hard drive, even though I'd revised it a bunch. So when he said there was renewed interest in it, I said, okay, let me dust it off and get it to you. So it was definitely serendipitous in that.
Well, it is unusual to have two books from the same author published at the same time, one being nonfiction, one being fiction. That's an unusual publishing event.
Yeah, I'm not so sure it's ever happened before, but that could be good and that could be bad, you know?
Well, but the fact that one is nonfiction, one is fiction, probably makes it easier. If you try to publish two novels at the same time, I think then you have a big problem. But
unless you're 50 Shades of Grey. You know?
True. Well, yes. I mean, there always are the exceptions.
Right.
But for the regular person, regular writer in a regular world, you know, trying to do two novels at the same time is virtually impossible. But I could see how the pairing of the two makes sense. And I think your publisher was correct that if I read, and of course I read the novel, I didn't yet read Writing with the Master, but if I were looking at Writing with the Master, I'm going to want to know how this process worked. How good is the novel that was the result of this process? Because that's, you know, that's so much of your story.
Right, exactly, yeah. Yeah, and for the millions of people who are aspiring novelists out there, you know, it's both a peek into a master's techniques and it's a sort of a step-by-step guide of how you go about doing these things.
Right. No, I think that's actually a really good story for a lot of writers, because, you know, today we have, you know, because it is so easy and I think it's also the generation of writer, of people getting to the point in their lives where, you know, if they ever wanted to write a novel, now they have the time or now they have the opportunity. It seems like there are more and more novels being written than ever before. And I think that this idea of learning how to write a book from someone who is an acknowledged master of plot and story is a really good thing.
Well, thanks. I agree with you. When I got John's first note to me, you know, I said, "Wow, I'm going to keep these because, you know, maybe I can make something of these later on." And when I decided to try writing a book, I said, writing a book about writing a book is about as interesting as watching paint dry. But I took about four shots at it, and I finally figured out how to do it. And then I got his permission to use the notes, and it went on from there.
Do you think that your background in advertising, because you spent a lot of years in the advertising business, and in advertising, you're telling stories also, just in shorter form. Do you think that contributes to your ability to tell these stories?
I've always been a writer, and you know, since I wanted to be a writer, and then have written since I was about 15. But I can't think of much relationship other than just the fact it's the same craft between advertising and novels. I mean, because advertising, the whole point is to get as much salient information in at a short period of time as you can. I mean, it's sort of battle with the clock. And novels don't have that same challenge.
I wonder, though, if the essence, you know, just because you're, you know, that in advertising you're forced to be so clear.
Yeah, that there's a good point. Yeah, that's relevant, sure.
So for people who are looking at your situation, you know, probably there are some writers out there who are just going to be jealous, because how many people get the opportunity to work with someone like John Grisham? How, what's the story of how you met him in the first place?
It's a very simple one. I mean, we live in the same town, and our kids, our sons and daughters went to the same school, knew each other, and our sons ended up playing on the same football team, and it was a little tiny co-ed school. And we won the state championship 1 year, and then we won it a second year, and it was a big family, wonderful family event. And we got to know each other well through that experience.
Yeah, I think there's, you know, there's that sort of interesting compressed time when your kids are in school. You spend a lot of time on the sidelines. If your kids are doing sports, you spend a lot of time on the sidelines, and you meet people that you would never have met otherwise. And I think that's an interesting kind of unexplored social setting for, you know.
It is.
And obviously it applies to only certain age groups of parents and only certain probably social or maybe certain parts of the country where it's, you know, more likely to happen. But I think I did read a novel last year or the year before. It's a zany sports novel by a California radio guy. It was, a lot of it was about the sports team relationships of the parents.
Sure, absolutely. And you get into little league moms and dads, and you get into some really juicy stuff there.
Yeah. Yeah, when sometimes people are really crazy on the sideline where, you know, it's a little embarrassing. You might not have those, it's not a conversation. It's where you want to hold your, you know, just want to bury your head and say, I don't want to know that person. Obviously, Grisham was not that way.
He was a spirited cheerleader for the kids' team, but we all were, but no, he didn't go there. But so we'd start talking, we'd talk about writing, what I'm doing, what he's doing, you know, and there wasn't much to talk about with me. There was always a lot to talk about with John because he's knocking books out of the park every 6 months. And then, you know, but nothing happened. I didn't expect anything to happen for, you know, 5, 6, 7 years. And then we had that wonderful lunch where he said, I'd like to mentor you. And that's how it felt.
That's a great story, and it's really very, it's generous of him, but he must have seen something in you in some way that made him want to do that, because, you know, I can imagine as a pretty well-established and well-known writer, your time is valuable, and you don't want to mentor someone if it turns out they're not going to be able to do it. So he must have had some way of judging that you were capable of writing a novel.
I'd submitted, I had an agent previously, and John said that he'd introduce me to his agent if I wanted, and I said yes, and I submitted to John's agent twice, and so he had read my stuff, and that's how John got that kind of feeling that you described, that I was capable of writing something.
So you've written this one novel. I mean, I know you'd said you'd written other ones, but after Sleeping Dogs, and when was that written? When did you finish writing that book?
I finished it in 06, and I went back to it in 09 and worked hard on it. So it's been in the hopper for a while.
And have you written other novels? I think I remember seeing on your website that you have other novels coming out. So how many novels have you written since you finished Sleeping Dogs and learned this method from Grisham?
I'm halfway into another one. But I have two other novels that were trapped on a floppy disk. You know, you remember floppy disks?
Yeah, we do, yeah.
And how when you try to put them in your computer now, the computer looks at you like you're crazy, you know? So I had to find somebody who had an old computer. I finally did, and he was able to resurrect these two novels. And they're black comedies. One of them is called Ads for God. It's a black comedy about advertising. And I couldn't get anybody to pay attention to it. People said nobody cares about reading about advertising, and then along came Mad Men, and so I'm hoping I can find a market for that. And the other one is called Say Something Funny, which is about reality. It's a black comedy about reality television. So I'm sort of taking a bit of a sidebar route here, but they are really entertaining books.
Well, I'll look forward to reading those as well. So is the one that you're writing now, that you're halfway finished with, is that also a thriller?
No, I'm going back to the advertising thing. It's called The Client from Hell, and it's about a mafia guy who takes over an advertising agency.
He can take care of those clients from hell.
Exactly. Yeah, he hangs them over the Chicago River until they get the message. I'm actually going back into Howie Collier and going to resurrect that cast of characters and do another thriller based on Sleeping Dogs.
I think that's a good idea. I think he is a pretty good hero. You know, I think you have to have a really good hero for thrillers, and you know, he sort of fits the mold of the modern. He's not James Bond.
Right, he's sort of the modernist James Bond. I mean, he's a technically oriented guy, but he's driven and he's smart. But he's also got some personal flaws that get in his way. So,
well, he's got a family, and
yeah,
and he's also a good guy. You know, I noticed this. I thought this was, you know, maybe something you did on purpose. But it's rare that you find a hero character in a thriller who's away from home, put in close quarters with an attractive woman, and nothing happens.
Yeah, that was a challenge. I finally had Sharon Thorson, the nurse who he's partnering up with on this chase after this nuke, say to him, you know, I could fall for you, Collier, but I'm not going to. And so they sort of dance around it, but she has too much. She's a solid lady and has too much respect for his relationship with his wife. So
right, and so does he.
I mean,
in that way, he's a good guy. You know, he doesn't just, you know, follow the male, kind of hero mold.
Right.
You know, where anything goes is because you're the hero, you can do anything and get away with it.
Sure. Now, so I'm gonna take him off on another escapade, probably starting this summer.
Well, I think he's a good guy. I liked him.
And he's got a great set of connections. You know, his friend Wynne Straub is now head of the CIA, and so he's resurrected. So he can involve Howie again in another marvelous adventure.
That's true. You know, I like your other good guy ending up as the head of the CIA. That does give you an opening to, I mean, you could do a whole regular series with these two guys.
Yeah, I can see that happening.
Yeah, it'd be interesting. Well, it is. I wonder if the, you know, you think about hero characters, you seem to have more and more middle-aged heroes, male and female. And maybe that's a reflection of the aging population of writers
right
and readers.
That. Yeah, there are billions of us out there wondering what the next act is, you know? And I think that creates a certain relevance for that group of readers when you talk about somebody who's off into another life and fumbling around in the dark trying to figure out what their role is and how they can best fill it.
Right. Well, and he's doing something, in this case, he's doing something that's really a really good thing.
Important.
No, very important. Although, also, still, you know, we have to, you know, at the end of the novel, you're left thinking, well, where are the other ones?
There are more sleeping dogs out there.
That's right. So, well, listen, it's been great talking to you, Tony. I really appreciate the opportunity, and I'm looking forward to reading Writing with the Master. I'm interested now, having read your novel, to know the mechanics of how it came about.
Good. Well, I look forward to having you read it, and I'll get you ads for God when that gets going.
All right, that sounds great. Well, thank you very much. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk. I've been talking to Tony Vanderwerker about Writing with the Master and Sleeping Dogs. Mm-hmm.